it's time to read the Des Moines Register for Friday, April 26, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dave Buzik, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Judith Linden. For this first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. Then we'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners just like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at a stormy forecast. National Weather Service says the first round of severe weather is forecast later today into this evening across Iowa. While there will be showers and storms this morning, this will mainly be below severe limits. However, that changes by late this afternoon, with severe storms moving into western Iowa that then push into central Iowa this evening and eastern Iowa later tonight. For central Iowa, the main window for severe weather will be between 5 p.m. and midnight, when large hail, damaging winds, and tornadoes will be possible. The forecast specifically for Des Moines and central Iowa today, windy plus showers and storms, severe weather threat for the afternoon and evening, a high of 66, and if that's not good enough, winds out of the southeast to 20 to 25 miles an hour with gusts up to 40. Tonight, scattered thunderstorms in the evening, then mostly cloudy overnight, a low of 62, winds slowing down to 20 miles an hour out of the south-southwest. Saturday, partly cloudy to mostly sunny for the morning. Storm chances return for the afternoon with a few severe thunderstorms possible. Severe weather threat returns for the afternoon and a high near 79, winds out of the west-southwest to 10 to 20. Saturday night, variably cloudy with scattered thunderstorms, a low of 62. Sunday, scattered showers and thunderstorms, high 74. Sunday night, chance of showers and thunderstorms, low 50. And then on Monday, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain, a high up near 68 degrees. So, not the greatest weather for the Drake Relays. In fact, we've got a story on the front page of the Register about that. Judith, good morning. Let's take a look at that story and others in today's Register.
Yes, the three stories. A stressful time. Iowa farmers begin planting amid lower prices and lengthening drought. FCC's net neutrality rules are back in place. And, as Dave mentioned, another soggy Drake Relays is forecast. What are the odds? And here is that story by Tim Weber. Everyone knows the old saying, April showers bring Drake Relays, or something like that. Accurate or not, the Drake Relays, the annual track and field meet that attracts high school, college, and professional athletes to compete on Drake University's Blue Oval, has developed a reputation for hosting bad weather. This year looks as if it will fit right into that trend. The National Weather Service was forecasting a 50% chance of rain Thursday evening during the Distance Carnival, and a high chance of showers with the potential for thunderstorms throughout the day on Friday. Showers and thunderstorms may also be in the cards on Saturday afternoon. So, are the Drake Relays under a perpetual bad weather curse? Or is this just a typical April in Iowa? Here's what we found. It's difficult to get through any three-day stretch in April without at least some rain. On average, the city sees 11 days with precipitation in April each year, according to National Weather Service historical data. That means roughly one of every 3 days it's raining. The Drake Relays themselves primarily run over 3 days, the last Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in April. So it is not unusual to get precipitation on at least one of these days. Admittedly, recent Drake Relays have been a bit wetter than those 1 in 3 odds would suggest. Since 2000, according to the Weather Service, there has been at least trace amounts of rain on an average of 1.6 of those 3 Relays days, more than half. Those numbers have been boosted by a soggy stretch from 2012 to 2019, when it rained on at least 2 of 3 Relays days in 6 of the 8 years. If the pandemic had not scratched the relays in 2020, the count would have increased to 7 of 9 years with rain. Perhaps that unlucky stretch has enhanced the relay's reputation for poor weather, but there has also been some beautiful relays weekends recently. There was no rain in 2021, although temperatures were a bit chilly. Two of the best Drake relays for weather were in 2013 and 2018. Not that you would know it if you attended Drake from 2014 to 2017, as this reporter did. If rain can be unpredictable in April, so can the temperature. Since 2000, it has risen as high as 86 and has fallen to as low as 29 during Drake Relays weekends. This year, temperatures are expected to range from the 50s to 70s or slightly higher than normal. While some of the morning sessions may be chilly for spectators, those conditions should suit the athletes just fine. A study published by the National Center for Biotechnical Information in 2022 found that air temperatures between 50 and 64 degrees Fahrenheit were most likely to produce peak performances from athletes, particularly in endurance events. Since 2000, every relays has experienced temperatures that settle in that range for some or most of the weekend. But this year's event looks like it could spend more time than most in that zone. From a spectator's point of view, it will be hard to top 2018's Drake relays. Temperatures rose into the 70s on Thursday and Friday, and into the 60s on Saturday, without a drop of rain. The year before that, however, was a tad more miserable. There were trace amounts of snowfall on Thursday in 2017, and conditions on Friday and Saturday were rainy, with highs in the mid-40s. The contrast between those back-to-back years shows that, while the relays may not be cursed with bad weather, anything can happen in this part of the country at this time of the year.
The next story on the front page of today's Register, a stressful time. Iowa farmers begin planting amid lower prices and lengthening drought. Three photographs with this story, photos by Cody Scanlon of the Register. In the top one, it's a view from the back of a tractor pointing backwards. A tractor pulls a planter filled with seed as the Heinemann family plants corn Wednesday near Ogden in Boone County. Second photograph is inside the cab of the tractor. It's got a picture of Marcus Heinemann shown in the mirror looking out the front as he guides the tractor as he plants corn Wednesday near Ogden in Boone County. And then a wide shot of the tractor, which is kind of a tracked vehicle with two big triangular tracks, almost like a tank, then pulling a wide planter behind it. And again, with Marcus Heinemann at the wheel. This story by Donnell Eller. Like other Iowa farmers, Aaron Lehman, L-E-H-M-A-N, hopes that recent spring rains will help pull his North Polk County farm out of a drought that's entering its fourth year. Lehman, president of the Iowa Farmers Union Board, said, "I don't think our farmers feel like they're out of the woods yet, but the last few weeks have been helpful." So far in April, 13% of Iowa's corn and 8% of its soybean acres have been planted. By May 1, that number likely will push close to 50%, given some good weather, according to Mark Licht, an associate Iowa State University Extension agronomy professor. He said, "We have really good planting conditions right now, with enough soil moisture in the top 6 inches to get good germination and emergence." That's a bright spot, he said, given that a month or so ago, he wasn't sure farmers had enough topsoil moisture to even get their crops started. But while conditions have improved, Iowa has yet to escape its drought. Across the state, the drought that began in 2021, the longest since a dry spell from 1954 to 1959, has left a 20 to 30 inch moisture shortfall. Much of the precipitation hasn't reached the parched subsoil. Tim Hall, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Hydrology Resources Coordinator, said, "It's going to take several months of wetter-than-normal conditions before we can declare the drought is over." In addition to weather worries, farmers also face tight profit margins. Economists forecast that prices this season for corn and soybeans, Iowa's largest crops, will be about even with their costs. In Iowa, the break-even price is about $4.60 a bushel for corn and $11.25 for soybeans, said Chad Hart, an Iowa State University agricultural economist. The USDA expects a second year of income decline for American farmers, with profits dropping 41% from a record high in 2022. That's when Russia invaded Ukraine, disrupting one of the world's largest producers of sunflowers, wheat, and corn, and driving up demand and prices for U.S. crops. Lehman of the Farmers Union said his members are having a really difficult and serious conversation with their farm lenders. Cash flows are going to be very tight, he said. It's a stressful time. Despite the economic headwinds, is there reason for optimism about growing conditions? The severity of Iowa's drought has lessened in many areas this spring, thanks to soaking rains over large parts of the state. Nearly 30% of Iowa remains caught in severe or extreme drought, with part of 9 counties in northeast Iowa hit the hardest. That's according to the most recent edition of the U.S. Drought Monitor. At the start of the year, it reported about 60% of Iowa was in severe or extreme drought. About 50% of Iowa is now in the less severe category of abnormally dry to moderate drought conditions, up from 36% in January. Nearly 25% of Iowa has no drought. That's nearly 7 times January's percentage. But not everyone has benefited equally. Jake Bigelow, who farms southwest of Winterset, said he has mostly missed the inch-plus rains nearby areas recently received. Even with forecasted showers ahead, he said we might only get 2/10 again while everybody around us gets 1.5 inches. It's frustrating, said Bigelow, but it's just the way it is. Bigelow also needs more moisture for the pastures where he grazes cattle that he sells directly to customers. The topsoil has been okay, some moisture, he said, but I don't know how long that'll last without sustaining rains. That's my concern, Bigelow said. Dennis Todi, U.S. Department of Agriculture Midwest Climate Hub director, said the weather pattern is shifting from El Niño to La Niña, with the new system bringing greater chances of warmer, drier conditions this summer. While the transition's timing is unclear, it's expected to occur by summer's end. In May, June, and July, most of Iowa is forecast to have a 33 to 40% chance of higher than normal temperatures and equal chances for above or below normal precipitation, according to the NOAA Climate Prediction Center. If Iowa crops don't get rainfall, plants will have to rely on subsoil moisture, and you could probably argue we've pulled probably as much water as we can from the soil, according to Hart from Iowa State. A few weeks of extremely hot, dry conditions could push areas into drought or deeper drought, stressing private wells and rural and municipal water supplies, according to Hall from the DNR. He said, we're kind of on that knife's edge where it could go one way or the other. It's not just farmers who are fretting over the weather. Some Iowa water supply systems are struggling. Osceola is weighing moving water from a nearby quarry or using the city's treated wastewater to recharge West Lake, its dwindling drinking water source. And this month, the Poweshiek Water Association ordered farmers around Tama and Amana to use water sources other than the association's for spraying herbicides. They want to preserve supplies for people and livestock. Recent rains have helped replenish some ponds, creeks, and pastures used to water and feed cattle and other livestock, said Denise Schwab, interim director of ISU's Iowa Beef Center. But all areas have not been so lucky. She said, it's a little discouraging when you hear 2 to 3 inches of rain and you get 3/10. Schwab's family farms in Poweshiek County. There, farmers will need to tap either their own wells or truck water from nearby towns and cities, both for livestock and spraying. Hauling water can be labor-intensive for producers who water cattle and other livestock daily. Schwab said she tells cattle producers they may want to consider trimming their herds this summer if they're short on forage, pasture, and water, and they still can benefit from high prices. She said if we stay dry, it'll help stretch their supplies. The ISU economist Hart says a good example of Iowa and U.S. farmer concern about profits is their shift from corn to soybeans. The USDA reported in February that U.S. farmers would cut their corn planting by 4.6 million acres. That's a 5% decline from last year. In Iowa, the nation's largest corn grower, farmers expected to plant 12.8 million acres of corn this year. That's 300,000 fewer acres than last year. It'll be the smallest corn acreage since 2006. Iowa farmers say they'll plant 10.2 million acres of soybeans. That's 250,000 more than last year. Iowa is the U.S.'s second largest soybean producer after Illinois. Hart said, noting that corn carries higher seed and fertilizer costs than soybeans, a lot of producers are trying to figure out how do I reduce expenses and save some costs. We see this shift towards soybeans when profits are tight. Bigelow said that he's keeping a close eye on expenses, especially with lower corn and soybean prices. This is the farmer from Madison County. He said, "It's definitely a tighter market. It's not as fun to get $4 corn as it was to get $8 corn." While Bigelow and other farmers see fertilizer costs declining, the most recent USDA forecast shows total production expenses will climb 3.8%. Land, machinery, seed, chemical, and other expenses are not retreating, said Michael Swanson, a Wells Fargo ag economist. He said the price run-up is not coming down during this period of softness. U.S. revenue from livestock doesn't offer a much better outlook, with cattle, milk, and egg production receipts expected to decline. But most of Iowa's eggs, so to speak, are in a different basket. It's the nation's largest hog producer, and while last year brought record losses, this year revenue is inching slightly higher. Hart said, looking at pork, things have been getting better. And the Madison County farmer, Bigelow, said lower corn prices have an upside for cattle producers like him, allowing them to lock in more profit as he feeds his herd cheaper grain. He said having some diversity helps even out the ups and downs. Despite the drought, Iowa farmers have produced large corn and soybean harvests. Last year's soybean crop was Iowa's third largest on record, and corn the state's fifth. Hart said, "It hasn't been 2012 or 1998 when the droughts truly took a big bite out of production. The drought thus far has not done that." Paul Heineman, who farms with his brother Craig and their sons near Ogden, said he was among the growers surprised by the abundance of his harvest last year. "Improved seed genetics help out a lot," he said. He said, "I think we take better care of our crop than we did." Heineman was pointing to practices like using fungicides to protect plants from disease and splitting fertilizer applications, with part provided early in the growing season when the plants need it most. He hopes that he and his family see another strong crop this year despite the drought. Boone County remains in moderate drought despite spring rains and this winter's snow soaking into the soil. Heineman said, "It can't shut off now. We're going to continue to need timely rain." Like the weather, smaller profit margins are on his mind. Heineman said, "Farmers always sweat the weather. It's part of our DNA, and the markets are the other thing we always sweat."
And a final story from today's front page. FCC's net neutrality rules back in place. Policy repealed in 2017 protects internet speeds. This story by Betty Lynn Fisher and Amritpal Kaur Sandhu Longoria from USA Today. The Federal Communications Commission on Thursday voted to reinstate rules repealed in 2017 that prevent internet service providers from disrupting your internet speed. The 3-2 vote along political party lines restores net neutrality, a policy that ensures your internet service provider does not block or slow legal traffic or charge more to deliver some content more quickly. The commission voted 3-2 in October to advance the proposal that would reinstate net neutrality rules and once again give it regulatory oversight of broadband internet, which had been rescinded under former President Donald Trump. The FCC said it was also using its new authority to order the U.S. divisions of China Telecom, China Unicom, and China Mobile to stop broadband internet access services in the United States, according to Reuters. The Chinese carriers must discontinue service within 60 days of the effective date of the order, Reuters reported. FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel noted the commission has taken similar actions against Chinese telecom companies in the past using existing authority, Reuters said. The pandemic and the way consumers use the internet for school, work, and healthcare made clear that to engage with the world, it had to be done through a broadband connection. Rosenworcel said Thursday during her remarks before the vote. She went on to say, "It became clear that no matter who you are or where you live, you need broadband to have a fair shot at digital age success." It went from nice to have to need to have for everyone, everywhere. Broadband is now an essential service, and essential services are ones we count on in every aspect of modern life to have some basic oversight, Rosenworcel said. Fellow FCC commissioners Jeffrey Starks and Anna M. Gomez voted with Rosenworcel to approve the rule. Some, no doubt, will claim this is all a scheme for the government to control the internet. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Dave.
You want me to take over? Yeah, okay. I will let you continue that story when I return to you right now. I'm going to move to... We're both suffering kind of the repercussions of a bad cough over the past week, so bear with us, listeners, if you will. I'm going to read a story on page 2A of today's Register, then we'll return back to Judith, assuming that she can continue. This headline, "I'm glad we know where he is, family says after body is found." The story by Jose Mendiola. The family of Northwest Iowa trucker David Schultz gathered on Thursday morning for a news conference and said that his body was found in a field on Wednesday. Sorry, now you got me doing it. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation said Wednesday, a person found a body in a field at about 2 p.m. The DCI acknowledged the location is near where Schultz's empty truck was found back on November 21st. Authorities have not publicly identified the body as Schultz. Schultz's semi-tractor trailer was found abandoned on a rural highway near Sac City in northwest Iowa, its trailer still filled with the piglets he was transporting. Police found Schultz's wallet and phone inside his truck and his jacket on the side of the road. Hundreds of volunteers subsequently searched for Schultz after his disappearance, and rewards were offered for information on his whereabouts. His wife, Sarah, said the body is Schultz's, and police identified him by his boots. Schultz was a 53-year-old father of two from Wall Lake. She has not seen the body since the recovery and has been told by officials that she wouldn't recognize him. She said in tears yesterday, "I'm glad we know where he is now. There's still a lot of questions. Things don't make sense, but we have him now." Sarah Schultz has since told her children about her father's death. She said, "I did have to break it to the kids yesterday. They still were holding out hope." Sarah Schultz asserted in the news conference that she believes that David Schultz's death was caused by foul play. "Nothing makes sense as to why he would be in a field," she said. "His coat was found on one side, and he was found on the opposite side." Schultz's body was taken to the state medical examiner's office, she said. "My biggest thing was to find him, just to not wonder where he is every day," she said. "That's a big step. I hope we can find out what happened and why. The biggest relief is he's here. It matters what happened to him, but I'm enjoying the fact where he is now. I can sleep a little bit easier."
Thank you, Dave. And I apologize, dear listeners. I've been fighting this for almost a month now, and I am sorry. I will go back to the story about net neutrality. And as I had just said, fellow FCC commissioners Jeffrey Starks and Anna M. Gomez voted with Rosenworcel to approve the rule. Starks said in his remarks, "Some no doubt will claim this is all a scheme for the government to control the internet. But let's be real. It is about empowering consumers to control how they experience the internet while ensuring the provider is not impeding or prioritizing certain content." Gomez, who also repeated her remarks in Spanish, said the action would offer protection for all consumers, but especially, she said, for those communities that have historically been left on the wrong side of the digital divide. FCC commissioners Brendan Carr and Nathan Symington cast dissenting votes. In his remarks before the vote, Carr said the internet has thrived in America in the absence of regulation by the government. Carr questioned whether internet service providers will continue to invest with the new rule, saying broadband investments slowed down after 2015 and picked back up in 2017 after repeal. And Carr said, "I am confident that we will right this ship, and I am certain that the courts will overturn this unlawful power grab." Reinstating the rules has been a focus for President Joe Biden, who signed a July 2021 executive order urging the FCC to restore net neutrality rules put in place under President Barack Obama, Reuters reported. Democrats were unable to make those changes during the time they lacked a majority on the five-member FCC, but that balance changed in October, Reuters said. During the Trump administration, the commission argued that net neutrality rules dampened innovation and discouraged internet service providers from putting money into the network. Net neutrality is the belief that an internet service provider should give all consumers a fair and equal access to legal content and applications. Providers should not favor some or block others. The FCC argues there are a number of net neutrality benefits for consumers. The openness establishes basic rules for ISPs so they do not block legal content, throttle speeds, and create fast lanes for people who can pay for it. Advocates and experts also say net neutrality is positive for consumers. Chris Lewis, president and chief executive officer at Public Knowledge, has previously told USA Today, "It protects consumers from ISPs controlling what you see." The Computer and Communications Industry Association, whose members include Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, and Meta platforms, support net neutrality, previously saying that the policy must be reinstated to preserve open access to the internet, according to Reuters. Meanwhile, U.S. Telecom, whose members include AT&T and Verizon, have said restoring net neutrality is, quote, entirely counterproductive, unnecessary, and an anti-consumer regulatory distraction, end quote. And that was from Reuters. In 2018, Verizon was accused of throttling Santa Clara County's unlimited data during the Mendocino wildfires, disrupting their ability to coordinate until they upgraded to an expensive service plan. It resulted in a lawsuit showing the effects of the FCC's repeal of net neutrality rules. At the time, a Verizon spokesperson told USA Today that the issue was not related to net neutrality court proceedings, but was due to a customer service error, and that Verizon had a practice for removing data restrictions during emergency situations. A dozen states have net neutrality laws or regulations in place on their own, despite the 2017 decision to withdraw the requirement at the federal level, Reuters reported. Industry groups dropped legal challenges to those state requirements in May of 2022.
And we will move now to the front page of the Metro in Iowa section. Four stories across the top. DART awarded $3.6 million to cover costs. Along the right-hand column, Central Iowa Waterworks has its first meeting. Picture story on the left-hand side. Volunteers help transform part of a forest preserve, and there's a story along with that. And then on the left bottom, bird flu virus found in raw milk, but federal agencies say pasteurization keeps the supply safe. Let's go to that story at the top of the page. DART awarded $3.6 million to cover costs. Federal funds will help stave off cuts for the next 2 years. This is a story by Virginia Bereda of the Register. A multi-million dollar federal award will spare the Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority from having to make significant cuts in the short term, but the bus system's future still hangs in the balance. The Metropolitan Planning Organization's Policy Committee last week awarded DART $3.6 million from the Carbon Reduction Program administered by the Federal Highway Administration. The one-time award will keep services afloat for 2 years while the DART board continues to search for longer-term sustainability options. Besides potentially cutting the D line, a free bus route that runs in a loop through downtown Des Moines, DART officials say they don't expect any cuts to services in Des Moines through June 30th of 2026. DART CEO Amanda Wonky said in a statement, "This funding speaks to how many people believe public transit is essential to our region. We have difficult conversations ahead as we work to find consensus on how to fund regional transit services, and I remain committed to my goal of elevating how public transit is an investment that drives economic growth and quality of life in our region." While the coast is somewhat clearer for now, DART is still barreling toward an estimated $6.7 million shortfall by fiscal year 2027, should it not find a viable long-term solution. The funding influx comes as Des Moines has considered how to help fund DART. DART asked the capital city to consider passing a 2.5% franchise fee, which is a tax on gas and electric bills, to fund public transit. That was approved by Iowa lawmakers in 2023. At least lawmakers gave the city the option to do it. Instead, the city of Des Moines recently opted to give $1.5 million to DART in fiscal 2025 and another $2 million in fiscal 2026. DART, primarily funded through property taxes, faces an estimated $4.7 million deficit in fiscal 2027 if Des Moines doesn't increase its share of the funding. Officials project an additional $2 million gap due to DART's expenses outpacing property tax revenue. This funding is based on a formula that takes into account the population and level of service in 11 participating cities and Polk County. Developed in 2021, the funding formula is being phased in to lessen the immediate blow to city budgets. Because Des Moines uses about 74% of the system's services, it eventually is expected to fund the bulk of what participating communities pay, about 49%. But the city already has reached its maximum 95-cent property tax levy for transit. The city of Des Moines contributed nearly $10 million, or about 38% of the total amount of property taxes to DART in fiscal year 2024. It needs to reach $17.5 million in fiscal year 2029 under this new funding formula. While increasing the franchise fee is not off the table, city leaders said in February there may not be an appetite on the Des Moines City Council to approve it. The one-time MPO award, Metro Planning Organization award, to be deposited in DART's capital budget will mostly sustain the transit service over the next 2 years, allowing the organization to purchase multiple buses, according to DART Chief External Affairs Officer Aaron Hockman. That award will free up funds that were originally allocated toward buses to instead use for operating expenses to fill in the gaps in the budget. DART still will have to cut $500,000 in administrative expenses in fiscal year 2025 to balance its budget, which likely will include eliminating onboard Wi-Fi and reducing customer service hours. The agency already has eliminated 3 administrative positions. Hockman said DART is trying to save its trip planner and next bus feature on its app and website, features that were on the chopping block before. Separately, the agency has batted around proposing an increase in its DART on-demand fare in July, which right now costs $1.75 per ride. Additionally, DART may eliminate the D line downtown, due in part to low ridership. It'll collect public input before making any decisions. So what's next? Commissioners are in discussions to do an extremely comprehensive study coined Reimagine DART that will explore its operations, said Russ Trimble, West Des Moines mayor and DART commission chair. Hockman of DART said, "Communities on the board will need to come to a consensus on what level of service DART will provide and how to fund it by December of 2025.
Central Iowa Waterworks has first meeting, this story by Addison Lathers. After years of planning, the Central Iowa Waterworks Board met officially for the first time Wednesday afternoon at the Mid-American Energy Company Recplex in West Des Moines. Des Moines Waterworks Board member Susan Huppert said with a smile, "This is a historic moment indeed," before she promptly nominated a presiding officer to call the meeting to order. The newly formed Regional Water System has only been a registered entity with the Iowa Secretary of State's office since April 11. While it is still in its infancy, the CIWW's board will have much to discuss before it becomes operational by January 1, 2025, after which the system will be expected to provide drinking water to about 600,000 residents. Jody Smith, West Des Moines Waterworks board member, told the CIWW board, Central Iowa Waterworks Board, "As most of you know, talks about regionalization date back a couple of decades, but for a whole host of reasons were unsuccessful. Thank you for hanging in there, for your advocacy of a shared goal, your attentiveness, and your willingness to speak your thoughts knowing compromise was necessary." Smith, the unofficial chair for the Central Iowa Waterworks, was officially nominated at Wednesday's meeting. David Jones of Ankeny was selected as the board's vice chair, and DMWW trustee Diane Munn as the board secretary. The position of interim executive director was also voted on, with the board choosing energy consultant and former Iowa Utilities board member William Smith to fill the role until a permanent one is found. Smith's rate is $150 per hour. The board approved preliminary bylaws with a final vote to be held at their next meeting. The board is comprised of 13 trustees, one from each founding agency, including two from Des Moines Waterworks. None will receive financial compensation. Those members include, from Ankeny, City Manager David Jones, from Clive, Mayor John Edwards, DMWW Board Trustee Diane Munns, also from DMWW Board Member Susan Huppert, from Johnston, Council Member Tom Cope, from Grimes, City Administrator Jake Anderson, from Norwalk, Mayor Tom Phillips, from Polk City, Council Member Jeff Walters, from Urbandale Water Utility, Board Chair John McCune, from Warren Water, Board Member Carol Freeman, from Waukee, Mayor Courtney Clark, from West Des Moines Waterworks, Board Trustee Jody Smith, and from Xenia, Board Chair Dan Lovett.
Bird flu virus found in raw milk, but federal agencies say pasteurization keeps the supply safe. This story by Donnell Eller. Bird flu virus has been detected in raw milk, according to federal agencies this week, but added that the nation's commercial milk supply is safe. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in a joint statement, assured consumers that milk from cows infected with highly pathogenic avian influenza is destroyed or diverted, and that the pasteurization process used for the vast majority of milk kills harmful bacteria and viruses. The FDA also noted that while pasteurization is likely to inactivate the virus, the process is not expected Therefore, some of the samples collected have indicated the presence of the virus, it said, but additional testing to determine if the virus was viable showed nothing that would change our assessment that the commercial milk supply is safe. The FDA, reiterating long-standing recommendations that consumers avoid drinking raw milk, said pasteurization is generally expected to eliminate pathogens to a level that does not pose a risk to consumer health. On Wednesday, the USDA issued an order to prevent the spread of the virus by requiring that dairy cows test negative for bird flu before they can be moved to other states. The agency also required veterinarians, laboratories, and producers to report any positive test results. The USDA's directive came after dairy cows in Texas and Kansas became sick with highly pathogenic avian influenza in March, marking the first time the virus had moved from poultry to cattle. Since 2022, state and federal officials have worked with producers to destroy 90 million chickens, turkeys, and other birds nationally to contain the disease. Though the disease is deadly to birds, infected dairy cows mostly experience reduced appetite and milk production before they recover. The virus has been discovered in 33 dairy operations in six states, in addition to Kansas and Texas, the USDA said. Idaho, Michigan, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ohio, and South Dakota. Iowa has no known cases of avian influenza in dairy cows or birds. Over the past 2 years, about 18.8 million birds have been destroyed in Iowa, the nation's top egg producer and seventh largest turkey producer. The latest bird flu detection in the state was December 20th, and so far, no cases have been reported among cattle. Here's what you should know about the highly pathogen avian influenza outbreak. How is the disease spreading? Wild birds can spread highly pathogenic avian influenza to domestic birds and other animals through their droppings and saliva. The virus has been detected in more than a dozen wild mammals, including brown, black, and polar bears, bobcats, gray seals, and bottlenose dolphins. In Iowa, the virus has been detected in red foxes and Virginia possums. How is the avian influenza virus spreading in cows? The USDA says the virus has spread between cows in the same herd, from cows to poultry, and between dairies associated with cattle movements. It also says cows without symptoms have tested positive. What about Iowa's large livestock population? Iowa Ag Secretary Mike Nagg urged the state's dairy and poultry producers to bolster their biosecurity to prevent the virus from entering their operations. Poultry producers have been on high alert since an initial wave of bird flu in 2015 when they were forced to destroy nearly 33 million birds. Scott Hayes, the former National Pork Producer Council president, told reporters this month that avian influenza is on producers' radar. But the Missouri farmer said the industry already has adopted strict biosecurity measures to guard against deadly diseases like African swine fever. That's an important issue in Iowa, the nation's largest pork producer. Iowa law allows raw milk sales. Is that dangerous? Well, Iowa for Fresh Milk couldn't immediately be reached for comment on Wednesday. National Group A Campaign for Real Milk said the federal agencies provided, quote, no supporting evidence of viral transmission from raw milk to humans in the peer-reviewed literature, unquote. The FDA said it continues to recommend the dairy industry not manufacture or sell raw milk or raw milk products, given limited information about the possible transmission via raw milk. Is bird flu from dairy cows a threat to people? One person in contact with an infected herd in Texas became mildly ill, the CDC said. The USDA reported being on alert, though. Last week, a microbiologist detected a shift in a virus sample from a Kansas cow that could have indicated it had an adaptation to mammals. Further CDC analysis, however, showed that it had been seen previously in other mammalian infections and does not impact viral transmission.
Volunteers help transform part of a forest preserve. Hundreds of native trees being planted to replace invasive species. There are a couple of photos accompanying this story. In one of them, we see Grant Menke and Doug Rosenboom as they are planting swamp white oak trees Monday at Strasser Woods in Des Moines. And the other, the Strasser Woods State Preserve is 40 acres, and it is made up of bottomland forest habitat that is part of the 4 Mile Creek Greenway. And here is the story by Virginia Beretta. Around 24 volunteers spent Earth Day with shovels in hand planting trees to restore a deteriorating forest preserve on the east side of Des Moines. After being left to grow unchecked for years, Polk County conservation officials are working to transform a portion of the 40-acre Strasser Woods State Preserve this spring by removing invasive species and replacing them with hundreds of native trees. The planting, which includes funding from the Iowa Woodland Owners Association, a nonprofit that advances the interests of woodland owners, is a tribute to a former member, Tom Brady. It is also part of a larger project to improve the site's ecology and build up resistance in an area historically prone to devastating floods. Here's what to know about Strasser Woods and the tree planting efforts. The 40-acre Strasser Woods State Preserve, located at 1552 East 36th Street in Des Moines, is made up of bottomland forest habitat that is part of the 4 Mile Creek Greenway and next to the Gay Leah Wilson Trail. The preserve features a half-mile hiking trail where users can see a display of wildflowers in early spring. Joseph and Elizabeth Strasser had owned the property since 1965 before they donated it to the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation in 1981, according to a news release from Bankers Trust, one of the volunteer companies planting trees. The woodland now is owned by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and is managed by the Polk County Conservation. And what is this planting event we're talking about? After years of leaving the forest to grow unchecked, Polk County Conservation, Iowa Woodland Owners Association, and volunteers from around the community are working to restore 13 acres of deteriorated bottomland forest at the preserve through forestry, mowing, and planting, according to conservation officials. Last winter, the county hired a contractor to remove invasive and poorly formed trees to make room for healthy tree growth. The next phase, being accomplished by dozens of volunteers, is planting 750 high-quality native trees, which officials say will increase the diversity of the tree species and, in turn, benefit Strasser Woods ecology and wildlife. Tree species being planted include sycamore, swamp white oak, Kentucky coffee tree, and bur oak, according to county conservation officials. Volunteers, primarily from a team at the Iowa Woodland Owners Association and Bankers Trust, Iowa's largest privately owned bank, began the tree planting last week. The work continued on Earth Day with volunteers from biofuel companies and organizations, including Growth Energy and the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. Other volunteers included the Boy Scouts of America. Also in attendance was Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship Secretary Mike Nigg, who touted Iowa breaking a record for E15 gasoline usage in 2023, as well as the state's conservation practices. Who was Tom Brady? Brady, who was known as the Man of Many Trees, was a longtime Polk County resident and former president of Toad Valley Golf Course in Pleasant Hill, according to county conservation officials. Brady also was the writer of a column in Timber Talk, a quarterly publication by Iowa Woodland Owners Association geared toward woodland owners.
Okay, I'll bail out Judith again. We're both suffering from the ramifications of a bad cough, so we're doing the best we can here. I'm going to go ahead and move on to this next story. Oh, you're ready? Okay, back to Judith.
Tom Brady planted literally thousands and thousands of native trees, Iowa Woodland Owners Association board member Steve Meyer said at the event on Monday. A what they are doing here with restoring this parcel, 700 acres of land, to what it originally was is very near and dear to me. And how does the restoration help with flood resistance? The Strasser Woods efforts are part of a larger project along the Four Mile Creek Greenway. About 800 acres of once residential, flood-prone land slated to be restored to native habitat, according to the county conservation. Des Moines' Four Mile Creek neighborhood was devastated by a 2018 flash flood. It forced emergency evacuations and caused damage to at least 1,800 homes in the city. Since then, the city of Des Moines has bought out many of the properties in the Four Mile neighborhood that sits in the 100 to 500-year floodplain that are prone to repeated damage, with much of the land now transferred to Polk County Conservation, according to County Conservation Ecologist Amanda Brown. A County Conservation Volunteer Coordinator, Melissa Dempsey, said, "We have somewhere around 80,000 residents in this watershed that are affected by it, so this is going to benefit them drastically and hopefully reduce that flashiness that is associated with the creek."
Headline: Why Des Moines Area Schools Aren't Letting Teachers Carry Guns Despite Iowa's New Law. The story by Samantha Hernandez of the Register. Iowa's largest and most diverse school district has no plans to arm its staff despite passage of a new state law. Neither do most of the suburban school districts surrounding Des Moines. Des Moines Public Schools' decision not to utilize the weeks-old state law is partially because the district already employs a public safety team. Phil Rader, the district spokesperson, said, "Des Moines Public Schools does not have an interest in allowing teachers and staff to be armed in our schools and has no plans to opt into a new program that allows for guns to be present in schools." The renewed conversation around whether school district staff should be armed came to the forefront during the 2024 legislative session following the deadly shooting at Perry High School in early January. The 17-year-old shooter killed an 11-year-old student and the high school principal before killing himself. Iowa school officials can arm staff under Iowa Code 724.4b, but districts have hit barriers in the process. Spirit Lake and Cherokee School District officials attempted to arm their staff under the previous code, but reversed its decision after insurance carrier EMC refused to cover the districts for the current 2023-2024 school year. The Iowa Department of Education does not collect data on which school districts approve staff to carry firearms, said Heather Doe, the department's spokesperson. During the 2024 legislative session, which just ended, Republican lawmakers introduced House File 2586, which allowed school officials to arm staff and grants qualified immunity for those who are given the okay to carry a weapon on school grounds. Lawmakers hoped giving school staff qualified immunity would help the insurance issue. Perry Community School District, which is still dealing with the aftermath of the shooting, has not yet considered whether to arm staff. Board President Linda Andorf said the new law has not been discussed by the board. Around the Des Moines metro area, school officials are weighing their next steps. A recent Iowa poll showed that 60% of Iowans are in favor of arming school staff, including teachers. More than 30 states allow schools to arm staff. Earlier this month, Governor Kim Reynolds signed House File 2586 into law. Des Moines School's decision not to arm their staff comes at a time when officials are focusing on overall district security and cybersecurity. Security became a priority heading into the current school year following deadly shootings at East High School in 2022 and the Starts Right Here program in January of 2023. The district was also closed for several days in early 2023 because of a ransomware attack. In response, the Des Moines School Board significantly increased what the district spends on overall security for the current school budget. Some of the increased budget went to expanding the district's full-time public safety staff, which includes armed personnel. Des Moines School Board Chair Jackie Norris said, "We believe that the role of our teachers is to educate our students, and the role of the district is to keep our students, teachers, and staff safe." House File 2586 also requires larger schools to employ a school resource officer, but it allows school boards to opt out. Des Moines schools officials have no plans to bring back school resource officers. The district continued its school resource officer contract with the Des Moines Police Department in 2021 following an audit which showed black students were more likely than their white peers to have an interaction with law enforcement officers in the school. The district safety plan includes a mix of measures, including campus monitors, targeted restorative justice approaches, which can help staff issues as they arise, building improvements, and updated technology. School Board President Jackie Norris said, "I think our teachers are our caregivers in the classroom, and I think that is the role that they want to play and have signed up to play. And quite honestly, I haven't heard from a single teacher or community member that has asked us to equip our teachers with guns at this time." The Johnston School Board's three-member policy committee met on Wednesday of this week to discuss House File 2586. District spokesperson Lynn Meadows said, "Johnston District Board policy currently prohibits weapons on school property. The policy committee discussion this morning focused on making edits to clarify the board policy." The proposed revisions, Meadows said, suggest that district officials will continue to prohibit weapons on school district property. A final decision is expected to be made by the Johnston School Board at its meeting May 6th. Waukee and Urbandale school districts are both planning to prohibit staff other than law enforcement from carrying weapons. Both school boards are expected to take up the issue in May. On February 19th, the Urbandale School Board unanimously approved a resolution supporting greater education and awareness on the proper, it says property storage of firearms. I think it means on the proper storage of firearms, School Board President Jason Menke said. Officials will need to update the student handbook to include information about adults' legal obligations regarding the secure storage of firearms and to provide parents with information about secure storage at student registration. Menke said, "I don't believe we'll have armed teachers in Urbandale in the near future." At Ankeny and Dallas Center Grimes school districts, officials are still reviewing the law with legal teams and insurance companies. Samantha Aux, Ankeny Community School District spokesperson, said Ankeny officials are reviewing the language of the new law to determine the policy, funding, and operational implications. Education officials and advocates said they appreciate that the new law gives school districts the opportunity to choose. Jackie Norris of Des Moines School said, "As a parent who sends their kid to school every day, I think I join with just about every other parent in this country that is worried about the safety of our children in a school building. And it is an issue that should be at the forefront of every single school district, but it should be left up to the school district to address that issue in a way that works best for them." The Iowa State Education Association was among those who registered against the bill, according to President Mike Baranek. "We do not agree," he said, "that it's appropriate to be arming our educators in our buildings when there are many other avenues which districts can utilize to ensure that our children are safe." Baranek said, "It's incredibly important that local control is paramount in this bill."
Severe weather likely to hit central and western Iowa. This story by Victoria Reyna Rodriguez. Severe weather will likely make its way back to Iowa this weekend. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday will all have a chance of strong to severe storms, the National Weather Service office in Des Moines posted on social media. The severe weather outlook for this weekend includes the risk of tornadoes, large hail, and strong winds starting Friday afternoon and evening. What is Iowa's severe weather outlook for Friday for today? The high in Des Moines will be near 65 degrees with a low around 50 degrees. Storms are expected later into the afternoon and evening from 3 to 11 p.m. The entire state has at least a marginal risk for severe weather, according to the Weather Service. That increases to a slight risk in western Iowa and an enhanced risk in central and southwest Iowa. Tornadoes are possible, with the greatest chance occurring in southwest Iowa. Forecasters said any tornadoes that develop in the area could reach EF2 strength. Storms will be fast-moving and could produce wind gusts up to 70 miles per hour. Hail 2 inches in diameter is possible as well. And we will finish this story after our break.